Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with Episode 72 of Weed All About It, or what I'm calling Spring Seeding with the WGC's Mike Carstensen, about my conversation with one of the newest members of the commission as he planted spring wheat. Throughout this podcast, you'll hear the background rumble of Carstensen's Case IH quad-track 500-horsepower tractor as it moves along at a little bit more than 4 miles an hour, planting a crop of soft white spring wheat. I'm sitting in the jump seat next to Carstensen, moving my microphone back and forth as we talk. For a man who cut his teeth on a D5 cat, the quad track is definitely a step up, with clean air, cushioned seats, and monitors galore, including a map telling him where he is in the field, with others indicating how much of it he's planted, his fuel use, engine output, and of course, whether his fertilizer and seed delivery functions are operating. The tractor is pulling an air cart with dry fertilizer, behind which is a 52-foot wide hoe-type direct seed opener. Although he's not a no-tiller in the sense of one pass over a field, his fertilizer application last fall, a harrow operation in the spring, and now seeding with a starter fertilizer leaves plenty of residue. Carstensen, who lives about 10 miles north of Elmira, Washington, assumed his WGC post in January. Besides the WGC, he also serves on the Highline Grain Growers Board of Directors, the cooperative that is the result of the recent consolidation of 5 smaller co-ops. He farms with his son Justin. His wife Lori commutes into Grand Coulee, 8 miles further along Highway 174, working for the National Park Service at Lake Roosevelt National Recreation Area. He has 2 other children, Blynn and Jake, who work off the farm. It was a beautiful April 25, 2018, when I arrived at about 10 a.m. in the morning. Carstensen was in the field planting. He stopped nearby, and I stepped through the disturbed soil and straw to climb the ladder to meet him in his element. As soon as I was settled, I jumped right in with the first question. Did you buy this new?
Unfortunately, I did. That means I have to make payments.
I did want to talk to you about the good years. The period from 2008 to 2013 saw above average wheat prices. Did you get healed up, and what did that period of time mean for you?
Anytime you double the value of a commodity that you raise, you just doubled your gross income. And so if you're smart about it and you didn't overspend, most guys got healed up. They should have got healed up. And they probably socked away some for a rainy day. I don't know if we'll ever have another super commodity cycle like that again. I don't know if I'll see one. I'm glad my father got to see it when he was here. And I guess if you look at history, you have to go back to the early 1900s, I guess, when it was many, many years ago they had a super cycle in grains. I'm glad my father got to see one. I'm hoping I get to see another one, but I don't know if we ever will have that again.
Now, the period from 2013 to 2018 hasn't been that great. Are you making money or bleeding equity?
I think in the worst cases of guys in our area, they may have been bleeding a little bit of equity, but I think most guys were treading water. The last turn down they had that was bad, we probably got rid of the marginal guys in this farming game, and you have pretty good operators left, and I think, like I said, most guys maybe probably in those bad years are treading water.
So as an accountant and an economist, do you know your cost of production here?
Everybody anymore does. They pin down their cost of production and so that they can decide where they can lose the least amount of money when they choose to sell, or make the most amount of money they can when they choose to sell. They got to cover their costs first, and then so I think everybody who farms anymore knows, has that pinned down.
How do you market your grain? Do you have someone who helps you, or is this something that you do on your own, or does your wife help?
Everybody's somewhat different, but we're pretty much all the same. That everyone watches the market. Maybe there's a few people that have somebody who they trust, but who do you trust more than yourself to do it? It's not an easy thing, so you keep track of all the information you can. And like I say, probably most everybody has a marketing plan, whether most of them are written down or maybe they're in their head and they want to cover their cost of production and then sell for somewhat of a profit. They kind of know the figure they can do, and when it gets over that figure, they let her go.
So what are we planting right now?
We're planting soft white. The variety is Seahawk spring wheat.
And why did you choose this variety?
Past performance, and like any farmer, it's what how their neighbor does with a variety, how you do with a variety, what's in the test plots and how those perform. And then the variety release pamphlet is another tool we probably use to choose varieties.
How much thought goes into choosing your variety in class?
I'm like any farmer. I think everybody puts a lot of thought into it. I mean, you want to do the best you can, and it's the start of a crop. So you want to have a very, very good variety that performs for you in your particular area.
Tell me about your rotation here.
We're in somewhat of a three-year rotation. Percentage of the ground is pretty dry, so it's a two-year rotation. We're cereal grains, so we've had a little bit of alternative crops, but not very much. Some guys are using canola. Some guys are trying peas or garbanzos, things like that. But we've pretty much stuck to the cereal grains.
You've been on the board since January. You've heard about the importance of quality overseas. Has that had any impact on how you go about your business?
You know, I think, Scott, that most farmers think about quality to some degree. It's always in the background. And when I say that, it's a better quality wheat sometimes you get premiums for, and a worse quality wheat you get discounts for. So the market somewhat kind of has trained us a little bit, but I guess I always thought about it in the background and is never in the forefront until I got on the commission, and I see how important it is for the whole value chain of that crop.
So I want to ask, you're planting Seahawk. Seahawk is a soft white spring. A lot of interest nowadays in hard red spring, DNS. Did you consider DNS? Do you have any DNS?
You know, here's the deal. I really think DNS, the price is going to be tremendous through this year. The problem with my ground is that it's all dry land, and the yield sometimes can vary quite a bit. So if I could guarantee a yield, I could fertilize for that yield and do okay. But if I put on enough fertilizer for an average crop and I get below average crop, I get way too much protein and I don't get paid anymore for a certain mark above 14.5. On the other hand, if I fertilize for an average crop and we get a tremendous growing year and I get a really good yield, then my protein is below the mark I need to make and I get discounted somewhat for what I have. So I just don't want to risk the extra cost in fertilizer not knowing what my yield could potentially be. It just depends on the year. And if I was irrigated and could take the variable out of rainfall, then I would grow DNS in a heartbeat.
Have you grown it in the past at all?
Yes, I have. And I've also go back to the 20 years or whatever when they were trying to real push for hard white in this country. We raised some of that hard white. And in each case, we were very close to making protein or right on the mark, but never over. So sometimes we're lucky, and when we didn't quite make the mark, we got somewhat of a discount, and I just didn't want to risk that this year.
Have you had any falling number problems up here?
Oh, yeah, and I think every farmer probably has it to some degree in some area and don't realize it because a crop in their whole field is blended. And that's similar with all our elevators. They probably have falling number. They take falling number wheat in every year. It's just not as big of a problem as it was 2 years ago when it was a region-wide issue instead of just kind of a localized issue.
And did you get hit up here with the late maturity alpha amylase phenomenon?
Yes, that I think everybody in this area 2 years ago got hit with it pretty bad. It was just that late frost that, I mean, it was region-wide, and Idaho and all of eastern Washington, we all got hit with it to some degree in the northern tier Highway 2 area, and I think we see a little bit of that every year, but it's such a small amount that it probably, if not as blended in the combine, it's at the elevator, they are aware of it, and they kind of can take care of it for us.
Tell me about this farm. How long has it been in the family?
My granddad started farming as a sharecropper many, many years ago. My father's 80 years old. It had to be 90 years ago, I'm guessing, at least, that some of this ground, one of us has farmed.
You went to college, went to WSU?
No, I went to Whitworth.
Oh, Whitworth. Wow, that's unusual.
Oh, it was a Division III college. I had a chance to play football there, and I did that and get an education as well.
So if you were going back to college today, would you have still chosen to major in business management, accounting, and economics?
You know, I think that's a loaded question, and I answer that by saying that I think all of us gravitate toward what we probably feel comfortable with and can do best at with the easiest amount of effort. And so I would guess standard answer would be I would imagine that's the way it would be.
How long have you been away from the farm in your lifetime?
You know, after college, I went to work for the Federal Land Bank, which ended up becoming Northwest Farm Credit. Tremendous place to work. Really enjoyed my time there. When I was there, I didn't know if I would have the opportunity to farm or not. My brother, who is older, was taking over my father's farm, or they were farming together. So I was probably away 5 or 6 years or so.
Have you ever missed a harvest?
No, I don't think I have.
And you grew up on this farm right here?
Yeah, I did. Where I live right now is a landlord's house, and that's a quarter mile away from the house I grew up at. So what we're looking at out the window right here is all my stomping grounds that I played on from a little kid all the way up until last night.
Now, you've got a rifle in here. Yeah, what's the rifle for?
As a hobby, I raise pheasants, and it really brings the predators in, and so we get a chance to get a few of them and kind of give a chance for the pheasants to live.
So does that mean that you actually have pheasant eggs someplace that you are raising and that you go out and seed the pheasants on your ground?
Yeah. The pheasants I buy as day-old chicks and put them in what they call a serrogator, and it's a self-contained unit that has food, water, and heat for the little chicks. And then when they reach about 4 weeks old, I turn them out of that serrogator, and they're imprinted in the area of where that serrogator is, and they won't leave if there's good habitat. In the past, it got to where we weren't seeing any birds at all, and I wanted my kids to have a chance to hunt birds. I figured we better raise them. And, you know, there's I would say 8 or 9 guys in this area in a 40, 50-mile circle that do raise pheasants and use these serrogators.
So you didn't know whether you were going to return to the farm. It just worked out that way, correct?
Yes, that's true. I didn't know. I actually didn't think there would be an opportunity. What my brother and my father farmed was not large enough for 3 families, and just didn't plan on ever coming back, and had a neighbor to my father that asked if I wanted to take his place over, and we wanted to raise the kids in the same area that we were growing up in, and so that's why we chose to come back and farm.
So your wife is from this area as well?
Well, she was from this. She was actually from the Eugene area and then moved to the local area in grade school. And so I guess if being in grade school till now, yeah, she's from this area.
Yeah, I think that makes her from this area, but only a fellow who was born here would make the distinction. What do you like best about farming? When you were making this decision about whether to leave Northwest Farm Credit and coming back to farm, what were you thinking?
I think that that's a lifestyle. It's a place to raise kids. You're your own boss. Just a very good area to live. If it was like that Palouse country, it'd be God's country, but we're not quite there, so this is God's outhouse. It's just a good lifestyle, Scott.
And now we are turning. We're at the end of the long straight stretch, and he has to pay attention to what he's doing here for a moment. So from an agronomic point of view, what's your biggest challenge on the farm? And when I say that, I mean things like weed resistance or pH or erosion.
Good question. I think it's all of the above. Erosion is an area that everybody watches. Weed resistance is a huge one when it comes time to spray weeds. There's being more and more of the pH problems. I don't know if we're quite there yet, but to some degree everybody's there.
Why did you decide to seek a seat on the Washington Grain Commission?
You know, I've had several friends over the years ask me to do it, and this goes back to probably when Dan McKay was on there and got off, and I just knew it was quite a time commitment, and I never quite had the time I felt to devote to it, to do it right. And now that my son is home farming with me, I think I've got the time maybe to get something done on the commission. Although I don't have any agenda, it's just trying to do the right thing for all of us, the producers.
Did your impression of the WGC square with reality when you got on the board?
It's like anything, until you're 100% immersed in it, you probably don't realize the total extent of it. Some things I knew, some things I didn't know, and it's baptism by fire.
And what didn't you know that you have learned?
I guess the interaction amongst the associations that the commission deals with and works with, an example of that would be U.S. Wheat. Didn't really know a lot about U.S. Wheat and realizing what a tremendous job they do for us overseas.
You have come on the board during a period of particular tumult. How would you describe your WGC initiation?
Well, I said it early, baptism by fire, but I've been on since January, and since then, the budget has been a little bit under duress, to say the least. The trade wars are looming. We dropped out of TPP, although I think we're seeing something on the horizon that NAFTA and TPP may get done. I don't know what ultimately the trade war means for us in the Northwest, but nationwide as a wheat grower, I don't know if it's as bad as the soybean guy, but still, China was a tremendous market. They worked very, very hard in the last 10 or 15 years to open up China and be able to get grain going there. And it seems like we got grain going there. And now that's going to put a halt to it anytime you make them pay more for it.
Are you following the news more closely as a result of sitting on the board?
Yeah, everybody watches the news to what they're interested in. And now my interest obviously lie in a little bit more the Grain Commission activities and things that affect them than just us producers.
You recently returned from a trip to China and Taiwan. What was your takeaway from visiting those two countries?
I've said it once and I'll say it again, quality matters. You go over there and you get a visit with the people that buy our wheat, and one thing for them is the quality. And when I say quality, it's a good variety of wheat that mills perfect for them. They like the clubs. They like the soft white wheat varieties. and they like DNS that has good protein. And so quality really matters. So it as a producer, it's important for us to keep that in the back of our mind. I mean, yeah, yield, we make more money with yield, but if we raise a crop that all of a sudden goes no bid and we can't sell it, what good is all the yield there is? It's a trade-off, I know, but quality matters.
So the Grain Commission funds activities in research, marketing, and education. How would you rank those in terms of importance?
They're all really important, but I have come to the conclusion that marketing is more important, research is second, and education is third. But they all go hand in hand. But I really think that marketing should be more of an emphasis than research, but not that research should lag.
You also sit on the board of Highline Grain. Is it important for Highline to have someone on the Grain Commission?
I think it helps. I don't think it hurts. I don't think it's an advantage over any other co-op for Highline to be on there. But I think it's a two-way street. The Grain Commission works for all of us. And Highline is a co-op owned by, in this area, all of us. And it's trying to do the best for the farmer as there is. So it's a hand-in-hand deal.
So each bushel of grain that you grow here and each bushel of grain every farmer in Eastern Washington grows is assessed at the rate of 0.75% of the price at the first point of sale. That money goes to fund WGC activities. Are farmers getting their money's worth? And we'll let you finish making this corner.
I think they are. That's a funny question. You know, it's just like anything in anybody's county. They want good roads and better signs, and they want their snow plowed in the winter. But when they come to pay their property taxes, they scream like a wounded Comanche. And that's probably the same thing a little bit with our assessment, is that, a farmer looks at it and says, man, I'm getting everybody's taking a cut out of me. But I'm not sure that they totally realize what the work that the Grain Commission does with that assessment. It was an eye-opener to me that everything that they're involved in. And one example I'll give is that they were behind giving container load of club wheat to Taiwan and having a U.S. wheat expert help Taiwanese millers show how they could mill that and what kind of quality parameters that had for their baked and flour products. I was told the other day that Taiwan actually had an order for club wheat. So there's a result of a sale that we never had before that we have now. And like I said, the Grain Commission was behind having that thing happen.
For some background, Taiwan used to take the Western white wheat blend of 20% club and 80% soft white. Until that is, the premium rose on short supplies to upwards of $5 a bushel. At that point, Taiwan bowed out of the Western white blend, opting for low-protein soft white instead. Folks in Carstensen's part of the world grow a lot of club wheat. He plans to put in some spring club himself this year. Having Taiwan tender for the specialty soft white subclass again is indeed a WGC success story, as is the attention Northwest farmers give to planting quality varieties. For the record, Seahawk, the soft white spring wheat Carstensen was planting the day I rode with him, is considered most desirable, the highest ranking for quality in the preferred variety brochure. That's all the time we have. I hope you've enjoyed episode 72, or what I've entitled, Spring Seeding with the WGC's Mike Carstensen. Please join me again next time for another episode of Wheat All About It.
Out in the country where a woman's called a gal, she's more than a lover, she's a farmer's best pal. We marry them for life, we marry with a vow, and even in the night we know how to plow. Our children have two parents, our children have a home. They don't grow up with no edible syndrome. We're the backbone of this country, the spirit of its soul. Best you ask for whom the bell tolls. We feed you. We feed you.